The tank is open, which means it's time for another edition of the Shark Tank Wrap-Up here on Reality TV Wrap-Up. So, hello, everyone. Mike Bloom here, joined, as always, by the one and only Jasmine Sidhu. Jasmine, how you doing?
I'm good. Hello, everyone.
So, we are here with a bit of interesting bonus coverage for Shark Tank. As we had mentioned on the previous podcast, this past week, Shark Tank was off, though they will be back next week for their final three episodes, a la SNL, in a manner of speaking. But we decided to take this as an opportunity to sort of dive into the pitches of the past on Shark Tank. We had over 400 products to think about over the course of Shark Tank's mythology before we came on to do this podcast. So we thought this would be a great opportunity to really dive into the grab bag, take a look at some of the most notable pitches and products that have come out of Shark Tank in the past six plus seasons and see where they are now. And in addition, there's also the spinoff series Beyond the Tank that we've talked about a few times. So we thought this would be a great opportunity as well to talk about what that series is like, how it differs from Shark Tank, what we like and don't like about it as well.
Yeah, I mean, we started this podcast a bit late in the season and late in the series.
Just a tiny bit late.
Right. So, you know, essentially we have over 6 years worth of pitches and scenes that we could be talking about. So we figured with this off week, we talk about some of the most infamous or famous pitches and products of the last 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, think of it as a T-E-O-S-T, if you will, just the very inklings of that.
Mike, did you want to talk a little bit about last week's episode?
Yes. So a couple things on that. First, we have to apologize due to some production delays and difficulties. It did not get out very close to the previous episode, and we do apologize about that. We hope you still enjoyed it nevertheless. That being said, I know we did kind of make a promise at the end of the last episode, hey, submit your possible pitches and products for us to review for this podcast. Unfortunately, again, due to that production schedule, we were not able to really get our hands on any suggestions. That's completely fine. I mean, as Jasmine said, there are a wide swath of things to talk about, so we were able to pick four really interesting products to talk about over the course of this podcast. But that being said, this will hopefully not be the last time that we'll do this thing. So if you have suggestions, be sure to let us know them over the course of this podcast, the podcast that we do, of course. But just know that there will be other opportunities for us to dive into these previous products.
Mm-hmm. And I think we pretty much have the entire summer to take a look at a few pitches here and there. So definitely let us know if there are some very funny or infamous pitches in the past that you'd like us to go over. And we'll go over four of them tonight.
Exactly. The summer is going to be nice and hot. You want to get into the water. So why not, you know, tread some water in the Shark Tank? And we'll probably talk about that later on. We still have a few weeks left of Shark Tank regular. But let's dive into the history of Shark Tank here. And let's go back to the ancient history of Shark Tank. As much as I don't want to call it ancient history, but we're looking at 2009 here. Let's start by talking about the very first product ever pitched on Shark Tank, Jasmine.
Mm-hmm. So this the series of Shark Tank in the U.S. Debuted on ABC August 9th, 2009. And to put that in context, to go back to 2009, I guess almost 7 years ago now, mm-hmm. This was just a little over a year after the recession started. So to think about this show debuting in that environment was a very interesting concept.
Yeah, and I mean, you can kind of tell the recession had its effect on the production, it seems like. I mean, there's some differences here. I would compare it to almost, you know, Survivor Season 1 had the big treasure chest in the middle and the gong. Or,
oh my goodness, yes, or the like, money that's just sitting on the table.
Yeah, or like Amazing Race had, you know, the greeter at the pit stop say hi to teams and tell them what team number they were, or Big Brother had Dr. Drew Pinsky on for the first season. There's obviously growing pains that come with this show, and the first season had a lot of visual changes than it does from Shark Tank today. As you just alluded to, Jasmine, there were literal piles of cash on the tables in front of the sharks, and I believe these sharks all started in front of a table, it looks like, instead of now when it just seems like they're relaxing in chairs you might find in your boss's office.
Right. And I mean, I was thinking about it, do I like this boardroom table situation they had in the first episode, or do I like the chairs? And I was gonna say I like the chairs because, one, each shark is kind of its own mini empire, so I think each having them have their own chair kind of visually symbolizes that, and it gives it more of an executive feel. And I think, yeah, so I would say, no, that was a good move to change it to the chairs from the boardroom table. I think it was a good idea to get rid of the money. That was a little cheesy.
Especially in the recession, like, hey, people tuning into this show, you probably lost a good amount of money in the past couple years. Well, here's some billionaires just gallivanting all their cash on the table in front of them. Probably right. Does not send the best message.
And for those who've only seen maybe the last couple of seasons, the biggest change that you might notice if you go back on YouTube and watch this very first pitch is a very strange and unfamiliar face of Kevin Harrington, who people might not have ever heard of if they've only seen the last few seasons.
Yeah, we have double the Kevin. Might not necessarily be double the fun is, you know, even if you just watch Kevin Harrington from this pitch alone, you'll realize he probably isn't the most magnetic shark presence. Jasmine, do you happen to know a little bit more about him and what path he comes from?
So yeah, Kevin Harrington, I guess when Lori Grenier came in, she kind of acted as a quote unquote replacement for him because he kind of got started in sort of the as seen on TV, selling products on TV kind of business. You know, he's made several appearances on the Home Shopping Network. He has, you know, from selling his products on TV, he's developed like a net worth of over like $500 million. And I think actually, you know, we use that term as seen on TV. I do think that's actually like a trademark term that I think he was involved with in terms of being on the board of directors there. So I don't know too much of him personally, but I do know that, you know, he was kind of that sell things on TV shtick guy. For whatever reason, I never actually looked up the reason, whether it was a network decision or his personal decision. He exited the show and Lori Grenier kind of took his spot as being that person who would, you know, has sold products through infomercials and, you know, TV products. And I thought it was an excellent choice to replace him with her.
Yes. And even though Kevin Harrington is apparently the king of as seen on TV, that won't necessarily help this first guy. The very first pitch ever seen on Shark Tank, Mr. Todd's Pie Factory. And essentially from what it seems like is that this man, Todd, the eponymous Todd of Mr. Ty's Pod Factory, decided to expand his business. He was based primarily out of New Jersey and has apparently had a roaring success with his pie business. And now he wants to expand it to make it more of a national chain, which, again, for the very first product ever pitched on Shark Tank is such an anomaly, I feel like, compared to the types of products we see today.
Right. And I just also want to comment in terms of, you know, different production changes we've seen from the very first episode. I've noticed like the music is a lot softer and, you know, this show is definitely not in HD.
Different voiceover guy as well.
Different voiceover guy, which was so jarring. We could talk about that later. And did you notice they do such intense close-ups on the shark's faces? I'm like, oh, I never noticed those details on Barbara's face before.
Yeah, well, maybe this was the advent of the HD era, right? This was like, I think Survivor Gabon was like season 17, and that was the first time a reality show was really in HD. So they're like, oh, great. HD is the new wave of the future. Let's start really focusing on the details of each shark. Though I think the sharks might realize after watching that, you know. Yeah.
You think they built it into their contracts? Like, you know, keep it a few feet.
Exactly. They say like, hey, you know what? Beauty might be only skin deep in some circumstances here. They're known for their business acumen, not necessarily for their good looks. I'll say that.
Right. So, you know, we have Todd Wilson here, who's from New Jersey, and he comes in very first pitch of the series, $460,000 for 10% of the company. And, you know, I would say you're right. This is not typically a pitch that we would see later on in the series. I think if he kind of came in sort of looking to save his business, where I feel like the trend that Shark Tank is going on, they want to be sort of the ones who boost up a business or an idea versus like, here's a business that's possibly crumbling. Let's inject it with cash and see what happens. But that might have been the vibe during the sort of recession era Shark Tank that they were going for here.
That's a great point. And I feel like they almost took that attitude that we see with Mr. Todd's Pie Factory and put it into Beyond the Tank. And we'll definitely talk more about that when we investigate the show itself. But I feel like this whole idea of, oh no, this business is going through some troubles, let's step in and save it, has become more the impetus of Beyond the Tank. And like you said, Shark Tank regular is more so about, oh, here's this cool new idea, I want to put money into it.
Right. So, you know, we jump into the pitch and Kevin immediately asks, you know, of this $800,000 that you've had in sales, how much of it is specifically the sweet potato pie? And Todd says it's 94% of the wholesale business, which is 50% of the $850,000. So we pretty much come to a quick conclusion that half of his revenue comes from one single flavor of the sweet potato pie, yet he's producing over 30 flavors of this pie. That seemed like an obvious one to me that Kevin pointed out. It's like, why are you focusing so much energy on multiple flavors when you really got one moneymaker here?
Yeah, Kevin is, I mean, it's again, first pitch of the entire series. Kevin is definitely showing what type of character he's going to be. He is very shrewd here. I mean, he gives the quote later on, "Don't cry for money, it never cries for you," because Todd also kind of has this sort of sob story about how when he was, this is his second attempt at a business. He first tried to do it. He said he had an MBA on the streets, and he essentially was living out of his car for a little while just because it failed magnificently. And so I feel like Kevin is really laying down the law of like, okay, this is the type of person I'm going to be on the show. I'm going to be the Simon Cowell, the Piers Morgan, et cetera, by essentially everyone else is kind of at least somewhat sympathetic to Todd's story, whereas Kevin's more about, okay, what are your profits? What are your margins?
Right. And, you know, Kevin and Robert were on the Canadian version of Shark Tank Dragon's Den, so they've had some time to sort of work on their personas a little bit. So you can see Kevin is already coming out with the, you know, no one cries about money, it never cries for you. And then Robert immediately comes back with, you know, emotions are real and money will follow emotions. So they've kind of already got down their sort of good shark, bad shark dynamic. And it'll take a little bit of time for the other sharks to really figure out what their persona is going to be. And for David, his persona is in this episode, investing, but in later on, possibly not investing as much, I guess.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about that as well. But yeah, Damon is also probably giving off a very good first impression, I agree, by being like, wow, this, even though I didn't really believe in this pie business, this guy Damon seems like he's really charitable, but we'll find out. No, I mean, we'll see in a case later on that Damon can be surprisingly shrewd to the point of where he might tease along investing in something and then back out at the last minute as well.
Right. So, you know, we see Robert go out of the deal because, you know, he's afraid that if he gives him money, Todd is going to start cutting corners again and expand too quickly like he did the first time. So he's out. Kevin immediately comes in and he's like, you know what? I want 51% of the company. We're going to cut the logo. We're going to cut the little guy that he has standing next to him, the mascot. We're going to drive.
Okay, can we talk about that for a second? Can we talk about this pie man?
Yes.
I mean, did he creep you out as much as he creeped me out?
You know what? He didn't actually. So what creeped you out about him?
I mean, the fact is, I can understand like, okay, I sell pies. Let me try to make a pie mascot. But the fact is, I just think it was maybe something in the design that looked like it was some, it looked like a piece of poop that had a cone around its head. Like, I can understand you want the crust to be very prevalent, but it just didn't look like a piece of pie to me. And I know he talked about how, like, apparently he brings it into schools to bolster this program about pies for good grades, which, I mean, I feel like, chefs might be up his ass about the fact that he's basically causing childhood obesity by promising pies for good grades.
Right.
But that was such a weird idea for me. And I guess, as he said, it's giving him a lot of notoriety, but you have to wonder.
You have to have visual branding, I guess, with your company. I guess it works for him, I suppose. So I didn't creep me out as much as it apparently creeped you out.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's because, I mean, again, as someone who doesn't get into sports, I'm usually not really into the idea of mascots in general, with the exception of course, Mr. Met, formerly helmed by the great AJ Mass.
Right.
But I it just did not appeal to me. And I kind of had to side with Kevin O'Leary here in that I would totally have just gotten rid of it. You don't need to appeal to kids, especially if you just like focus your business idea on one specific type in one specific store and try to release it nationwide. I feel like that's a fantastic jumping off point.
Right. And, you know, we get to sort of the kicker here where Robert asks, you know, do you have any hard copy orders that you can't meet production on? And he, you know, drops the bombshell that, you know, he kind of has a deal in development with McDonald's to get a kiosk set up in their fast food restaurants, particularly in the South, which is, you know, huge.
Yeah, I mean, we'll definitely talk a little bit about probably where are they now, do our own little version of that.
Right.
But I also don't know what the logistics of that would be. I could definitely understand if it was like at a mall McDonald's because kiosks are very fervent there. But would you just like, if you were in Charleston, would you just pull up to the McDonald's there and there would be a Mr. Todd's Pie Factory just sort of in the corner of the interior of the restaurant?
Yeah, I'm trying to, it's been a while since I've been in a McDonald's, but I'm trying to think, like, you know, don't they usually have this kiosk set up for like the toys for the Happy Meal? So, you know, kids can see what toys are available. So maybe
I mean, that's like a display case. It's not really a kiosk where you can sell things.
Right. Maybe I need to go see McDonald's sometime soon and do some research.
I am not encouraging, just like they get the disclaimer at the beginning of every episode of Shark Tank, I am not advocating that Jasmine go to McDonald's. That is her personal decision if she wants to.
Right. I'll report back to you. But yeah, no, we come back, we cut to commercial, and we come back, and Barbara's saying, you know, I love what I hear, but she wants to go in for half because she wants twice the equity. And she's saying that she wants 20%.
I was going to say, well, then Damon comes in with this interesting offer. And again, very against what we usually see of Damon to be going in for a deal, let alone going in for a deal with somebody else. But he says, okay, I'll offer a 50% stake that I'll split with Barbara. And it seems like, you know, Robert in particular was saying like, hey, Todd, you really need to think about this. You're essentially giving up half your company if you do this. But it seems like it worked on Todd and Todd takes the deal.
Right. And I think Todd presented himself as someone who is a little bit desperate, I think, in the sense that, like, you know, he gave the story and I think he came in really hungry for a deal. You know, at this point, he doesn't know what this is going to be. The Sharks don't really know what this is going to be. So it was just kind of like, you know, let's say yes and see what happens because, you know, I really need this help for my company. So the very first deal that goes down for Shark Tank is $460,000 for 50%, giving away half the company. And Mike, did you look up actually what happened with this company 7 years later?
Yeah, it quickly went from deal to no deal.
Right.
Apparently, after the show, Todd kind of had a change of heart and realized, like Robert said, oh, crap, I just gave half my company up. I don't want to do that. So their deal fell through. I couldn't research what happened with that McDonald's deal either. It doesn't look like that went through.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like, again, he's still based in New Jersey, though. From what I looked up, he still has plans to expand to a couple of New York locations, but he's staying pretty much local for now.
Right. And you know what? I think it was smart for him to reject the deal. So for a few of you guys who don't know, the deals that happen on the TV show aren't necessarily legally binding. Both the Sharks and the participants can go on into the real negotiations where the paperwork gets made up and they can back out at any time. So even if they say yes on the TV show, that doesn't necessarily mean a deal actually happened on the back end. So this was one of those situations.
Wait.
Yes.
Jasmine, are you telling me that something was staged for the sake of reality TV that might not necessarily be real and legally binding? That is ridiculous.
I know I'm blowing your mind right now, Mike, but this is a reality show.
Wow. And
yes. So yeah, you know, I don't know what percentage, that would actually be something great to research if we ever had time, what percentage of the on TV deals actually become reality, but a fair number here and there don't actually come to fruition. And, you know, those are the ones that they never talk about, obviously, during the Shark Tank updates and, you know, Beyond the Tank. But yeah, you know, this is one of those situations where I think it was smart for him to say, you know what, this is, I can't give away half of my business, but it's an interesting thought to think about what would have happened if he did take that deal and if he would be beyond where he is right now.
Did you also like the sort of post-mortem confessional from Todd where it was just him in front of a pure white background?
Yes, definitely the production value increased substantially as the show went on.
And of course, they had the last words of the segment be Shark Tank really works, to just really affirm to this crowd, like, hey, this show does things, even though, again, this thing completely falls apart after the show.
Well, they didn't know that at the time, to be fair.
No, yeah. No, definitely not. So let's move on to our number two pitch of notable pitches over the years. And number two is the proper spot for it because it is the aforementioned Squatty Potty as championed by Richard Hatch. And here, Bobby and Judy Edwards, the mother and son founders of Squatty Potty.
Right. So I have an interesting story. So as I've mentioned here and there on the podcast and to you, Mike, I just moved out here to San Francisco. So I've been spending a lot of weekends at Bed Bath & Beyond. And 2 weekends ago, I see the Squatty Potty in Bed Bath & Beyond. And I cracked up laughing and I wanted to send you a picture of it, actually. So, you know, off the bat, we know Squatty Potty is an immediate success because I've seen it as recently as 2 weekends ago in such a huge store, Bed Bath & Beyond. But here we are. I think this pitch originally aired in season 6, which was...
Only last year.
And I think for any RHAP listeners out there, they might have heard of Squatty Potty through a very ringing endorsement by original Survivor winner Richard Hatch. And we have Bobby and Judy Edwards come into the tank and they explain what this product is. Mike, do you want to just quickly explain for people who don't know what Squatty Potty is, explain what this does?
Yeah, so essentially the way they described it scientifically is that there is apparently a muscle called the puberectalis muscle. And essentially the position that we currently, and I apologize, this is going to get a little scatological moving forward because this pitch is all about a device that helps the business of evacuating your bowels. But essentially the puberectalis, and if you're in a certain position where you're sitting at a 90 degree angle, it almost chokes off the muscle so that less waste is disposed of in a way. So essentially what the Squatty Potty does is they bring up the fact that, you know, around the world, people often dispose of their business in a... It's going to be a lot of euphemisms.
I love the way you're struggling to describe this, but go on.
I'm trying to find new ways every single time. But people around the world actually use more of a squatting motion, and that actually is healthier because, again, that puberectalis muscle is in a more pliable position, and so more waste is released. So essentially, they're bringing that sort of mentality into the Western toilet world by bringing out what essentially looks like a step stool that comes out under the toilet, and so you put your feet up on it, it gives your body a different angle so that that muscle is released and more waste is released in a healthier stream, I guess I'll use that term, and just leads to a healthier lifestyle overall, or so they say.
Right, and it's something that stores actually neatly underneath the toilet, and they come in asking for $350,000 for 5% of the company, and all the sharks are immediately like, whoa, because that puts it at a valuation of $7 million. So, you know, they immediately ask them after they kind of get over the chuckling of what this is and that sort of video demonstration that they have of the colon. They say that they've been in business for 3 years. In the first year, they sold $1 million. Second year, they sold $2.7 million. In the third year, which is the year that they're in right now at the time of filming, they said they've sold $2 million so far that year. And I think it was Kevin that yells out loud, holy crap. And that's going to be the first of many euphemisms, I guess, of
we can just use the term puns here. Puns, and this is probably a difference between season one and season six Shark Tank. I feel like the season one sharks would not be nearly comfortable enough to just make a bunch of poop puns over the course of 10 minutes. But here they are raring to go. I mean, Bobby, one of the founders of it, is about to finish his pitch using his own poop pun when Mark Cuban interrupts with his own pun of how do you squeeze out a profit. And that's basically, if you like poop jokes and you like business, this is a perfect YouTube video for you to watch.
Right. And it's interesting to compare this to the very first pitch because that first pitch had such a serious tone. It was, you know, a man trying to save his business. We were in the middle of a recession. Fast forward 5 years and Shark Tank has become sort of a little bit more of has more of a comedic edge to it. You know, they have more joke products that come in where the sharks can laugh about. They have products like this, you know, where they make a lot of poop jokes. So, you know, the show has definitely taken a lighter tone over the years, which I think was a nice decision because, you know, not everyone wants to like watch serious shows about money and how people's businesses are failing. They want to feel that sort of inspirational hope that they can also start a business, but also be entertained at the same time.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, what do you think about the Squatty Potty overall? I think Kevin makes an interesting point when he says, why don't you just get a stack of books? And I was reading some YouTube comments on the video that showed this segment alone, and some people were saying like, yeah, I just pull a step stool out of my closet and it does the same thing. Do you think the Squatty Potty brand is really so unique that people are really adamant about purchasing only that? Or do you think there are people that just use knockoffs like step stools or things of a similar height in order to get the same position?
Well, books can definitely work if people want to go there. I would never feel comfortable of putting my books on the floor of my bathroom. the step stool is an interesting idea. I think what's going for Squatty Potty is the idea that it curves around the bottom of the toilet. So you can neatly put it away and it's not interfering in any sort of the space in the bathroom. And I like the idea that, you know, if this is something that you want to do, it's a ready-made product that fits neatly beneath your toilet. It's specially designed for this, and it doesn't actually cost that much. It's only retailing at the time. I don't remember what the retail was in Bed Bath & Beyond when I went last weekend, but at the time of filming, they say they retail it for $25, which is, you know, not a lot of money, and they make it for $4.50 in the United States. So they're raking in the money. They're getting excellent profit margins here.
Definitely. Now, I know last week we talked a little bit about those two magicians and about the fact that we felt they were kind of making the show circuit almost, in that they were on Shark Tank, they were on America's Got Talent, they were on Stephen Colbert. We have a little bit of that here with the Squatty Potty. Obviously, they got the Hatch endorsement before the product was even on Shark Tank. But Lori pointed out, you know, they talk about this huge boost in sales over the past 3 years. But Lori kind of calls them out and says, well, you were on Dr. Oz a little while ago, and they also got a big endorsement from Howard Stern as well. I mean, do you think that the Shark Tank appearance, even though due to the fact that they only wanted 5%, do you think part of it was just them getting that Shark Tank bump again and getting their name more out there?
I definitely think so. I mean, you can't help but think that when, you know, they've been on Dr. Oz and they got Howard Stern like shilling their product. What I think they were going for here is they mentioned that they've only been online. So I think they came in with the idea that, you know, if we don't get a deal, we're going to get exposure. But I think they really wanted a deal, particularly with Lori, because they figured they really wanted to be in retail. And they figured this was their shot to get into retail and not just be sort of this online product, which, you know, can have a ceiling for sales at a certain point. So they come in and they talk about what they expect for their sales at Christmas. Apparently, 43% of their sales come at Christmas because this is a great gift to give around the Christmas season.
I don't know if that insults the person's food that they make during Christmas, that like, hey, I'm going to need this after grandma's Christmas cooking.
Yeah. So, you know, we start getting into the different offers. Of course, we get a few more puns in there where Robert's like, let me clear the throne.
And he pulls a Darnell Hamilton. He goes with his gut.
He goes with his gut. And he's just like, you know what? It takes a while for people to change such core habits in their lives. And he just doesn't see it. So he's out. And then we have Lori. And she's the one that brings up, 5%. That's a little bit of a nothing burger. That's one of Kevin's famous lines that he's developed over the years. She thinks that this could do really well in QVC. Retail is harder, but she feels like she needs 10% equity. So she's offering $350,000 for 10%, which is pretty much slashing their valuation right in half, right on the spot.
Yeah, well, Kevin was the first to do so. And Lori kind of makes a similar offer. But I want to talk a little bit about this guy, Bobby, because... Actually, we'll find out after Lori makes her offer. Both Mark and Barbara are going to be out essentially because of Bobby. I mean, Mark says he's kind of talking out of both sides of his mouth. Barbara just kind of calls him weaselly and that he seems mistrusting. Did you get that impression from Bobby? I mean, that's a pretty harsh thing to say in front of his mother.
Right. I mean, that didn't bother me. You know, the mother was definitely awesome. Yeah, I mean, I can't put my finger on Bobby. Like, it's not that I don't think he's trustworthy and not that I don't think he's lying anything about the sales, but it's just that, you know, some people are just good salespeople and some people take that over the line where they start to trend into the phony territory. And I think he's been doing this for so long. Like, he's been on Dr. Oz, he's been on radio shows, he's been in that sales mode for so long that he's lost that bit of authenticity that I think you need to be a really good pitch person on Shark Tank.
That makes sense. I mean, I didn't think he was terribly weaselly, but I think there was a sense of artifice there. And he wasn't necessarily the best businessman as well. Again, when Kevin offers $350 for 10%, Bobby tries to counter by basically just multiplying his initial offer by two, saying, okay, you can have 10%, but it's for $700,000, which, again, just is ridiculous. I mean, we talked a few weeks ago about, you know, our rule set for Shark Tank. Should a rule of people going on Shark Tank be never pitch only 5% equity in your product?
100%. They're always going to say that that's too low for me. I think the minimum these days is 10%. And you got to know when you come in with 10%, they're going to come back at you with 20%. So unless you're willing to give at least 15 to 20% of your company away, then you shouldn't go on Shark Tank.
Yeah. And though, again, I, by those constraints, I feel like they got off relatively scot-free in that, you know, even though Lori refuses their counteroffer of $500,000, they decide to go with her. And as you talked about, I saw a little bit of not a beyond the tank, but a where are they now interstitial, where Lori had put them had released them publicly through all Bed Bath & Beyond stores. In that segment, they said the night their episode aired, 158,000 people visited their website, and they sold $1 million that night. They sold $12.3 million since being on Shark Tank. Obviously, they got a lot more celebrity endorsements, but probably the most culturally significant thing that came out of Squatty Potty as of late. I don't know if you know this, Jasmine. They came out with a YouTube commercial that got a lot of attention over the past several months.
No, I didn't see this. Tell me about this YouTube commercial.
So, yeah, this, like, I wouldn't say it put it on the map as much as everyone kind of knows about it now because of this weird commercial where essentially what they were pitching was they started off having this animatronic unicorn pooping ice cream. And here's this man who's sort of dressed up as a proper British pirate, essentially talking in a brogue accent about how unicorns make ice cream by pooping, and he uses the unicorn to essentially explain how the Squatty Potty works. They bring up the pubercolis muscle, pubercolis muscle again. I'm assuming it's just because probably an animatronic unicorn pooping is probably a more friendly image on the eyes than watching someone actually demonstrate it. But so I can understand it, but it's just so weird, like not exactly like Starburst commercial weird, but it's definitely getting there. And then it ends with a bunch of kids eating out the ice cream unicorn poop. And I was talking in my computer. I was saying, no, stop it. What are you doing? Stop. Stop it right now.
Oh my God. I just pulled it up. Oh my God.
The last 30 seconds are just so disturbing. And it goes from like a Starburst commercial to like an Adult Swim show. And over the course of like 15 seconds with its ending.
My mouth is just like dropped open. I'm watching this right now on YouTube. Oh my goodness.
So we'll link to all of the YouTube videos that we watch for these pitches, and I'll be sure to include the commercial for the Squatty Potty as well. I believe it was one of those commercials that airs as kind of interstitial ads before, in the middle, and after YouTube videos. So that's how a lot of people found out about it. So the word got out there. I don't know if that word is good or bad at this point.
I mean, they say there's no such thing as bad press, right? We're talking about it. It's a memorable commercial, so maybe it was a success.
Kids eating poop, Jasmine.
Hey, I'm not endorsing anything.
Endorsing anything. If you go to McDonald's, it might be the same thing.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, like I said, Squatty Potty was a huge success, so it ends up being one of Lori's Hall of Fame products. And it's funny to look back on these pitches and to see the other sharks being like, oh, you know, we don't really see this being successful. And the sort of the irony of what we know now today of how successful some of these products are and how they might have missed out on a lot of money. And I think the best example of that is our next pitch, which is probably, I think, one of the most successful products to come out of the Shark Tank, which is Scrub Daddy.
Yeah, so we saw this, and I believe we actually saw Squatty Potty as well during when we first covered Shark Tank during the Where Are They Now kind of omnibus segments, where it was Lori at the trade show and Barbara's big gathering at Cabo St. Lucas. So this is Scrub Daddy. As you said, we've talked about it before, arguably the most profitable and successful product to come out of Shark Tank, helmed by a man named Aaron Krause. And if you don't know what it is, it's essentially a sponge that changes texture depending on the temperature of the water. So if you use warm water, it'll turn into a pliable kitchen sponge. But if you use cold water, it becomes a lot harder, almost like a scouring pad. First, let's just talk about this guy's presentation. I mean, this guy screams infomercial. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it seems like he used the Scrub Daddy to scrub off the cocaine that he did right before coming into Shark Tank.
Oh, come on. No, we can't be sued for defamation now. Let's walk that one back.
All right. Maybe not. But this guy was going way too fast for my liking.
I mean, I think some people are just high energy. He seems like a high energy kind of guy. You know, he's built for infomercials. I think Damon at one point says, like, I've never witnessed a live infomercial. He must have been practicing this pitch, not even for Shark Tank. He must have just been practicing this pitch for years, you know, thinking that his way to go would be to sell this on TV, to sell this in demonstrations and stores. So he's got this perfected down.
And yeah, definitely. And he's been on QVC three times at this point, so he has to have some sort of pattern down. And he was almost in like autopilot, where, you know, people could have thrown comments his way and they would just bounce right off, because he had a script, he was sticking to it, and he gets through a lot of information, including an overhead shot of a grimy, grease-laden stovetop that he's able to easily clean off. But despite his speed, I feel like the sharks are really stunned by the efficacy of these sponges.
Right. So we should mention that this originally aired in 2012, which was season 4. And Aaron comes in with this scrub daddy asking for $100,000 for 10%. And it's, you know, it's really great to see and know where Scrub Daddy is today. And you'll hear him talk about where it is during this pitch. So he's talking about how they only sell in 5 supermarkets in the Philadelphia area. They've only been on QVC 3 times, and their sales are just north of $100,000. He said, you know, he's got patents, he's got 2 more pending, he's got the trademark, he's got domain names, he's got his stuff together. And he's looking.
He's got his squatty potty business together.
He's got his squatty potty business together. And, you know, he's looking for that Shark Tank boost. And during this entire time, did you notice the intensity in Lori's face as she's like watching this guy? Like, you can tell right off the bat that she's hungry and she wants this.
You have to wonder, though, if this guy's been on QVC 3 times already, A, does Lori already know about him? B, did Lori sort of function as an in to get him on here? Could he sort of name drop her in the application process?
I'm not sure about that. I mean, if she is as close with QVC as she is presented to be, there's no way she can't have heard of him before, especially since he's been on 3 times. So maybe that's why, like, when he came into the tank, she's like, oh yeah, I know that this thing is good and I want to get to be a part of it.
Yeah, I would definitely see that, which, again, it'll end up coming back to her, but it seems like Aaron, yeah, as you said, Aaron really has his stuff together here. I mean, he has those patents set up. You would think that the sponge with a face on it comes off as very tacky, but there's actually reasons why the sponge does have a face on it. He says the eyes work really well for you to put your 2 fingers in and sort of clean the bottom of hard-to-reach surfaces like the bottoms of glasses. And the mouth is a good way to clean off spoons. So it seems like everything is there for a reason, and it's a really simple product overall. Kevin takes fault with the idea that he charges $280 for sponges. Jasmine, is $280 too expensive for you to buy a sponge?
Well, they said it costs them $1 to make it and $280 to sell it wholesale. So they probably sell it even more in retail. And yeah, it kind of is pretty expensive. Like, I think they brought up the example of the Brillo pad, which is the lowest end of the lowest end. And you're like, yeah, this makes this costs 5 cents to make. I would really have to go out of my way to spend $5 on a sponge, because I imagine I'm thinking in my head, like, I would go through a sponge fairly quickly in my kitchen, and I don't want to be dropping $5 every month, every 2 months, when I could be dropping $1. So that's sort of the hesitations that the sharks start bringing up during this pitch.
Yeah, but this is where the Shark Tank bump really comes in handy, because, again, at the surface, you look at it and you don't know the product and you think, oh, yeah, I agree, I'm not going to spend $3 on this sponge that could break in 3 weeks like all my other sponges. But if you know how well this product works, it's almost like an investment. And so, you know, I feel like even though Kevin Harrington isn't around, stamp that as seen on TV sticker on this product, and people are going to believe in it a lot more.
Right. And so, you know, we start digging into the pitch a little bit. I think Robert is the one who's the first one to say he just simply doesn't buy into the vision and the retail vision, which is really funny to think about where this product is now. And Robert was obviously wrong, and he goes out of the pitch. They talk a little bit about display shippers, and that's kind of how they want to get this into the stores. We have a little bit of a discussion about how those are expensive, and even if you do pay for them, you don't necessarily get those placements within stores. That's something that Damon brings up. Mark's issue with this, though, he's like, you know, put aside QVC, you're just a one product company. And he's like, no, I've got Scrub Mommy, I got Scrub Kids, you don't understand who you're dealing with here. So he starts to talk about how he really does have a vision to take this one product and make it into a full suite of products and company. And this is where Mark has sort of his little bit of a cringy line where he's like, you may be the scrub daddy, but I'm not a scrub pimp. What did you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the most you can get away with a prostitution joke on a what's called a referred to as a family show. That's just that was just weird to me. I mean, stick to poop puns, Mark. Yeah, apparently you're a lot better settled for that than making prostitution references about sponges.
Right.
That was not a sponge-worthy joke.
And it's another example of like the progression of where Shark Tank is today, where they're kind of loosey-goosey with the puns and the jokes, and we're joking about poop and we're joking about prostitution apparently. Yeah, and so we come back around to Lori, who I mentioned. I just noticed she had this like very intense look on her face during this entire pitch. And Mark was like, or Lori was like, you know, don't knock QVC. We do $8 billion in sales a year. She's personally done $500 million in sales. And Mark was like, you know what? That's not that impressive because you just rotate products in and out. And once products are out, they're out. So if you've only got one good product going, you can sell it for a little bit, but you're not making a company out of that.
Again, let's remember this is the guy that just made a prostitution references, and now he's sort of referring to the QVC products in the same manner. So clearly Mark has his own philosophy about the way these household products work.
Right. So Kevin is actually the first one who makes a offer, and it's a wonderful offer for Mr. Wonderful. He offers $100,000 for 50%, and everyone knows this is a joke. Everyone laughs. Aaron's like, you're out, and they laugh at that comment, and they know that this is not a deal to be taken seriously. I think he was just trying to, you know, mix it up and make the pitches start flowing out. So I don't think anyone considered that a real offer.
No, definitely not. But Damon is really the first one to genuinely bite at this. He offers $50,000 for 15%, but with the interesting contingency that he wants Lori to raise the rest. But Lori sort of surprises him and says, I don't need you. And so she goes with her own offer of $100,000 for 30%, and she touts out, I can get you onto infomercials right away. I can get you into retail stores in weeks. So it seems like, and Kevin's going to buy in actuality soon. It seems like we have a three shark race at this point, which is very unheard of on Shark Tank.
Right. And I was so like, I love this episode because I feel like it shows the best version of Lori. I know you originally said like, oh, she's a warm blooded shark. I'm like, no, she can lay down the law when she wants to. And she just says to Damon straight up, you know, I don't need you. I have my QVC connections and I can do this deal without you. And I don't have to give away more money than, you know, I can make more money without you. So she makes this offer. Kevin adjusts his offer and he goes into a royalty deal, which is one of the deals that he likes. He's offering $100,000 and he's like, I will give you 50 cents on every unit that you sell. And then after I get back my $100,000, I'll get 10 cents back in perpetuity. A little trouble saying that word. And then he's like, you know, this is a great deal because you don't have to give up any of your equity. And you know, considering where Scrub Daddy is today, that's something to think about that, you know, if he had gone with Kevin, A, would he have gotten the same success? But B, he would still be owning 100% of his company. And then next we have Damon, who seems like he wants to be in this deal, apparently. And he's offering $150,000, so $50,000 more than what Aaron was asking for 25%.
Yeah, so he's essentially undercutting Lori. By the way, I'm sad you didn't use the perpetuity joke with Squatty Potty, because there was definitely a pun waiting on there that could have gotten you on Shark Tank.
I'm not as sharp as you, Mike, so...
Oh, stop. You're much sharper than I am. I'm the butter knife that's used to cut the steak in the example that was used with the Squatty Potty. So, yeah, there's a little bit of a bidding war that goes on, which, again, is very rarely seen on Shark Tank between Damon and Lori. So, as you said, Damon goes with 150 for 25%. And he, even though he doesn't do QVC, he says, hey, I have a $500,000 deal with Walmart. But Lori says, okay, I'll match that, $150,000 for 25%. Damon goes to 175. Lori goes for 200,000. And then Damon just sort of pulls his line away at the last second saying, I'm out. I just wanted to do that to get Lori to bid more. And now essentially he got Lori to bid twice as much for a lower share of equity than she initially did.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much I really believe that Damon was just like sticking it to Lori, but it's a fun interaction because, you know, Damon's increasing his offer amounts and Lori's like doing cute little head nods where she's like, you know what? I'm also going to do that amount. And Aaron's just standing there watching as more and more money is flying towards
him. He is aghast. He is just so, his eyes are wide, his mouth is agape. He's just looking back and forth, believing like he has dollar signs in his eyes. That's probably the closest I've ever seen to someone have dollar signs in their eyes in real life.
He's also sweating profusely on his bottom chin. I don't know if you noticed that, but you know, this is a tense situation for him. So we end up with Lori offering $200,000 for 25%. And Aaron comes back a final time being like, would you go down to 20? And we have this moment of pause where Lori's thinking and she's like, you know what? I will. So this is how Scrub Daddy goes down in Shark Tank history with a deal with Lori for $200,000 for 20%.
And essentially Damon John saying, ha, 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 look what I did to you, Lori. This product will never work. And look who's talking now.
Look who's getting the last laugh. So do you want to talk about did you do a little research of where Scrub Daddy is today in terms of numbers?
I mean, I don't have hard numbers, but if you look at their website, I know Aaron made the promise before that he wants to roll this out into a franchise, and he, in essence, did. I mean, the Scrub Mommy is out there, which is essentially a two-sided sponge. There's a Scrub Baby as well. I think he talked about using them for baby bottles. There's just a big hunk of sponge that you can cut out to make your own custom sponges as well. So this guy has really just created an entire empire out of this initial pitch. And, you know, again, like you said before, it's really fun to watch how basically everyone except Lori is basically like, well, I don't know if this thing will work or not. Lori, you made a big mistake and look where it is now.
I mean, yeah, so I did pull up a few numbers. So as we mentioned, at the time of filming in 2012, I believe, he had only sold about $100,000. So since then, he has sold more than 10 million units and made over $50 million in sales. So that deal with Lori is looking pretty good right now.
Absolutely. She definitely, you know, she bought the goose that ended up laying the golden egg in a way, and not, you know, no squatty potty needed to do that.
I was
going to
say, does that goose need a squatty potty for that egg?
No, I think goose legs, I mean, geese squat anyway, I feel like, when they lay eggs. So I feel like they probably, maybe the founders of Squatty Potty looked towards the animals at first, because the animals always know first how to do it. So the Scrub Daddy, I mean, it also we should probably point out, this and Squatty Potty both appeared on Beyond the Tank earlier on in this season. And I think Shark Tank just continues to tout it out as sort of like its golden child, as the most successful product to come out of it, because it really has done wonders. And good on Aaron, even though he seems a little manic, he really was able to be successful in his dream and not only get this product licensed and successful, but is able to roll out a bunch of products under the Scrub Daddy umbrella label.
Right. And I think, Mike, in our very first episode, you mentioned how this product was really like the Kelly Clarkson of the series, where it was just knockout.
Some people wait a lifetime for a scrubber like yes. this.
It really was the knockout product or success story that the series needed to show, like, hey, this actually works. Like, we're not just, you know, making up little pitch stories happening here and then. Like, this show has a real life impact. And I think that's why they want to just trot out Scrub Daddy whenever they want, because it's the epitome of showing that the show works. The show has a real life effect. And if you're an entrepreneur, you need the Shark Tank.
So let's move on to our fourth pitch that we'll talk about today, looking back on the history of this show. And this is, I believe, from what, like season two, I think. So you talked before with the Squatty Potty about how the show is kind of oriented more towards not necessarily jokey pitches, but definitely products that probably make for better TV than they do better businesses. And this is definitely an example of that. This is called I Want to Draw a Cat for You. And it's probably most well known for the pitch session. But before we get into it, this is our first time of the four pitches we've seen that we get our little pre-package here. A man by the name of Steve Gadlin, who, again, does not allude to his product. They still like to keep the mystery of that. But he seems like a relatively normal guy. He's a husband and a father who works building websites for a living. But he has a creative side to him, it seems.
Right. So, you know, in the pre-package, they tend to not actually describe fully what the product is going to be. They kind of tease it here and there. So, you know, we see this kind of a little bit of a nerdy-ish looking man. You know, he's a web developer. He's got a family. And he's like, you know what? I've come up with something. And everyone always laughs at it at first. But then you realize this is a really great idea and everyone's going to buy it. So we're teased a little bit about what this is. So we got Steve Gadlin coming into the tank and he starts dancing and rapping.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about this. I mean, clearly, so Steve has gone on to say that, like, this product initially started as a joke. I believe the first version of his website was essentially just a YouTube video, which I'm assuming had this song in it, and a PayPal button. But once he saw that people actually liked it, then he decided to make it, you know, an actual thing. Sort of like, maybe the No Phone is almost like a spinoff on this in a way, of a sort of a joke product that actually might have some legitimacy. But he puts on this, like, royalty-free rap beat, and he starts talking about how, you know, it's almost like a Dr. Seuss-esque rhyme about, like, I can put your cat is fat. I can put your cat in a hat. And he talks about how his business is essentially you just pay money. And he draws a cartoon of a cat that ranges from, you can tell them what you want him to draw, or he could just draw anything for you and he'll send you the picture.
Right. And can we just talk about this shimmy that he does? It's a very contagious shimmy, which we're going to see a certain shark do later on when they make a deal with him. But
it reminds me of in the Peanuts Christmas special when they're playing, you know, the Linus and Lucy, the very famous song from the Peanuts, and all the kids are doing different dances. I'm pretty sure one of the kids does that dance or a version of it at some point.
Right. So it's like he just comes off as such a lovable guy. Like, and this pitch sort of toes the line between, like, is this a joke or is he actually being serious? And I think it walks the line throughout this entire pitch where, you know, he even says, like, you know, I charge $9.95 for this and $9.32 of that is profit. And, like, he kind of says that, like, with a tongue in cheek, even though that's an excellent profit margin.
Yeah, he says there's an economy for stupid and I'm rolling in it. So he's very aware of, like, I can't believe this is working either.
Yeah. And then, like, you know, it's a legitimate question. Like, why are people buying this? And he says, you know, people ask it for their dead pets. You know, people kind of do it as a joke gift. You know, they ask their friends, like, what can this guy draw? And then they share it with their other friends. And he mentions that he can draw about 25 in an hour. And in a single week, he can knock off about 1,000 of these. And he's like, you know, when I'm not drawing cats, I'm building websites. So, you know, there's no overhead for me because I'm already at home making websites. And in my free time, I guess, I'm drawing cats.
Should our overlord, Rob Cesternino, take up this sort of business where he's already working from home when he's not podcasting? Maybe he can recruit the Suns to do it as well, to just draw a bunch of pictures to send out to listeners and fans.
I will draw a Survivor chicken for you.
Yes, I want to draw a chicken for you. It seems to be the popular thing on reality TV these days. So, Jasmine, we see, you know, Steve has his own samples here. He drew each of the sharks in their own little cat-like setting, and we've obviously seen a lot of pictures as the video comes up. I mean, in your opinion, is Steve a good cartoonist at all?
Not really. I mean, it's definitely not stick figures, so we should get that out of the way, but it's not like high quality cartoons either. It's kind of like in that middle ground where it is exactly what it's supposed to be, which is kind of like a joke image. And I think, you know, it's a little bit beyond a stick figure, but it's not like the most amazing thing you've seen in the world. And I think, you know, he's right. Like, it delights a lot of people. It just hits that sort of sweet spot where it's like, you know, you can tell these are cats in the image, but it's not great. I mean, he's only sold 1,200 of these, which is kind of incredible once you think about it. It's just this one guy doing this company. But, like, you know, the obvious question that they bring up is, this company can only grow as fast as this one guy can draw.
Yeah, which is pretty ridiculous. And I mean, he didn't even talk about, like, maybe I can bring in other people. And he purely wants to hoist this business onto his shoulders, which we'll talk about what happens to the business later on. And it might be a reason why they ultimately befell the fate that it does. But I mean, the first few sharks are, you know, just incredulous about this idea. And they kind of, in a way, politely kind of refuse the notion. But there's one guy who's really, really into the idea. The one and only Mark Cuban loves I Want to Draw a Cat for You.
Which, you know, blows my mind. Like, you have to think, for a billionaire Mark Cuban, he sees this as, like, what's $25,000 for him? So we should mention that he's asking for
That's exactly what I thought. I thought, like, well, 25K is sort of a drop in the bucket. I mean, Steve asked for 10%. Mark is able, he's able to get, you know, 2.5 times more for only, like, 8% more equity, which is, this guy must be the best con man I've ever met if he's actually able to do so, or Mark Cuban is just that much of a rube. But, yeah, I guess considering his net worth, $25,000 is, like, you know, if we're going back to season one, that's probably, what, two of his stacks of cash that he would have on the desk?
Right. And again, like, I don't think Mark actually thinks this is going to be some massive business. I think what happened was they must have seen a ton of pitches that day that were just duds. And, you know, here comes a guy. He seems very lovable. He does a little shimmy and a dance. He's making cartoons that makes people happy. He's only originally asking for $10,000. And Mark's like, you know what? Let's just make this guy continue to make people happy. He makes me happy. Here's a check. And I'm taking a third of your company and you do your thing, bro.
Yeah. But in exchange, I have to draw every 1,000th cat, which I'm not sure. Maybe I'll dive a little bit into the website to see, if Mark ended up delivering on that part of the deal, or if that was something that was figured out off camera that was taken that was stricken from the deal.
I did. So I did try to do a little research. I think Mark did draw a few drawings that they were able to auction for charity. So I thought that was like a fun little thing, because there's no way Mark was going to have to do every thousand of those. And Mark is an okay sketcher. He's not terrible, I have to say.
Is he on Steve Gatlin level of cartoons?
I think their skill levels actually match. They're about the same. If anyone wants to Google Mark's cat drawings online.
Now, if Mark was really as shrewd of a businessman as he may come off, he would definitely start his own spin-off business and completely undercut Steve altogether.
Right. It would be Mark draws a cat for you, but by other people.
Or outsourced. I want to draw a cat for you even more.
Yes. So, you know, this was a fun little pitch. And again, if we go back to the first season of the show, very lighthearted. This is not a pitch that would, I think, happen in sort of the first half of the first season. They've definitely oriented themselves of trying to find a mix between viable companies and products like Scrub Daddy, but also ones that are extremely entertaining just to even talk about, like this one or even Squatty Potty. So it's interesting to see sort of the evolution there and how they kind of found the sweet spot between real business and entertainment.
So I want to talk a little bit about where are they now. And I've received a couple of different sources. I mean, I read on Wikipedia that apparently Steve had stopped taking orders in January 2015. And this was after 4 years and almost 19,000 custom cartoons, because he said it's sort of run his course and he was working on other stuff. But I went onto the website and it seemed like you could still order things. So unless that function is just not outdated yet, it seems like that Wikipedia article, and I know, big surprise, but this part of Wikipedia might be false.
I mean, yeah, so that was the same information that I got, that he just closed the business after selling 18,000 of these, which, if he was selling them for $9.95 each, was a revenue of about $180,000 for this ridiculous idea.
Oh my God.
So good for him. I don't understand. Like, I can understand him being tired of physically drawing these himself. I don't understand why he wouldn't just outsource that drawing to someone. Like, he could hire illustrators to kind of keep this going and keep the demand going. But maybe he just wanted his personal touch in every one of his drawings. And if he couldn't do that, he didn't want to run the business anymore. But I don't understand why he just didn't hire an illustrator on the back end and just pump out these drawings.
And it's interesting, going back to why Mark really bought into this pitch, I feel like Mark was looking for the meme out of this, almost, that the idea that like people on the internet will go crazy at this idea. And they did to a certain extent, but maybe that's sort of dried up a little bit. And, you know, again, this guy is a husband and a father. Maybe there was something going on in his personal life. Maybe he just said, like, hey, this is a business I started as a joke. I want to do other stuff and I don't want to do this anymore. I will make a promise here. I'll utilize my shark accountability this week. If the website is indeed still up and he's still making custom drawings, I will pay money to get Steve to draw a cat for Jasmine and I together.
Oh my goodness.
I'll post the picture online. Well, so that is my promise to you listeners.
What was my shark accountability last week? It was the stroll.
It was that you would sign up for the email list for Kid Runner. By the way, any updates for Kid Runner in the past week?
I have not received any updates from Kid Runner, so I'll keep you guys posted. It is
okay,
still in research and development.
Well, if this podcast is still around in 2020, maybe we'll finally get an update from Kid Runner then.
Right. So it was a fun idea, I think, for him, but I think he just kind of lost interest in it. I mean, to do anything for four years is pretty intense, especially since he apparently has a pretty decent day job, and this was not something that could sustain him full time. So it's understandable.
So, yeah, I mean, I'll repeat what I said at the beginning of this podcast. This was really fun to look back. I mean, we got one from season one, season two, season four, and season six. And these were definitely four of the, I wouldn't say milestones, but definitely a few rocks in the river that is this show. So I'm hopeful that there will be some more opportunities moving forward for the two of us to check out more of these notable pitches.
Right. And so going back to the idea of like checking in on where products are today, that was, I guess, the original concept behind Beyond the Tank, in terms of expanding those little shark updates we get in the actual episode and stretching that out to make it its own series. So do you want to talk a little bit about Beyond the Tank?
Yeah, so essentially how this works is, again, we talked about this before, take those interstitials that last for like 2 to 3 minutes in any Shark Tank episode and essentially stretch them out into 13-minute segments. And that's basically Beyond the Tank. Essentially, they'll take a look at not only products that got a deal, but sometimes they actually look at products that did not get through the tank successfully. Either the person didn't take the deal or they didn't get any deals. And one shark will usually, they'll visit that business at some point in time. The business is from what the few episodes I've seen, the business is for the most part going through some troubles, whether that be, you know, leadership, or whether that be, you know, too little space, or wants to go in a different direction. And the shark will come in and essentially give them advice about where their business should go next. And we talked a little bit in our very first podcast about how this has a very different tone than the original Shark Tank, in that it's definitely a little more serious. It's almost like the first season Shark Tank, in that it's more centric on the business and specifically the day-to-day operations of the businesses themselves.
Right. So, you know, we talked very briefly about Beyond the Tank, but we can dig into it a little bit more. So, you know, it's this expanded version of, like, what happens to these products? I think that's a number one question for any casual viewer when, you know, they're sitting down to watch the show. They want to know, like, what happened to the Scrub Daddy? What happened to the Squatty Potty? Did it actually become a massive success like they predicted it to be? So this show kind of addresses that question. And again, it fills a time slot for ABC, so it was an excellent choice for them. It does have more of a serious sort of docu-series tone. And I think the Shark Tank, especially, you know, lately, as we talked about it, the Shark Tank itself has a very light, inspirational tone. This one is a bit more serious because they are digging into business problems. It's not necessarily like, here's a ton of money that can save you, but, you know, we're having problems with manufacturing. You know, my co-founder quit. We have all these orders and we can't meet demand. So they're going through some very real business problems. Well, I might walk back the word real, because I do have a question of how many of these problems are staged or produced versus actual problems that these businesses go through, because, you know, essentially this is a reality show. So they kind of had to create what is the obstacle that's going to happen with each of these businesses. But I think it's a great companion show for those who really want to dig into what happens in a business. And it definitely has a lot of teachable moments. I know families are a huge audience for Shark Tank. So this is a great companion show to show, you know, it's not just getting money. It's not just getting investment. Running a business is hard work. And I think this show does show that.
Yeah. I wonder about the filming schedule as well, speaking to an earlier point that you made. I mean, obviously, from what we talked about, it seems like Shark Tank almost films in a season of Shark Tank just films in like one big chunk, where the sharks will just sit there for periods of time and have pitch after pitch come in. So essentially, I guess they have a lot more months to travel around the country to visit these companies. But I mean, for example, like, if one company has a big pitch that they need to do in November, is the shark going to visit them in October, or is the shark going to visit them when they're visiting all the other companies? You know, when, how long are these segments in the can before they end up on the show? Because like you said, their businesses are running constantly in flux, and there are things that sort of ebb and flow in the natural business cycle, where a business that might be suffering, you know, in February might be doing really well in May, and then, you know, you don't need to do the segment anymore.
Right. You know, that's the thing with Shark Tank. The timeline has always been a little bit sketchy of, like, when these things are actually filmed. I know with Beyond the Tank, they do method of Beyond the Tank is you introduce the business and they're like, oh, you know, we got this deal, you know, with Barbara or with Lori, and our business is doing great. But, you know, we've run into these problems, and then they have sort of the stage scene where the shark visits them, and, you know, the shark gives them their prescription or their sort of advice. And then they do sort of a break for most of them, like 2 months later, we're doing great again. But you never know when that 2 months is and like what exactly happened. So the timeline for a lot of this is a little bit not sketchy, but like you just kind of don't know. And I think that just works with production schedules, because then they can place these episodes in whatever chronological order they want and whatever viewing schedule they want.
What do you think about the segments themselves? We usually get 4 pitches on an episode of Shark Tank. Beyond the Tank only covers 3, and they almost always are stretched out between 2 acts. To me, they feel a little fatty. Maybe they went to McDonald's and had some sweet potato pie, but like you said, it does seem a little staged, to the point of where it almost seems like they're like plotting out certain elements to write like a 13-minute webisode of Shark Tank, the scripted show.
Right. I mean, so that would be my biggest criticism of Beyond the Tank, is how staged this feels sometimes. I feel like, you know, with the Shark Tank, when they're pitching, it's more organic, because you actually, you know, those pitches don't happen beforehand. This is the first time we're seeing that participant talk to the investors. Even though they might have rehearsed their pitches to like producers, this is the first time they're interacting with the shark. So there's an organic element to that, because, and a little bit of drama, because you don't know what's going to happen. Beyond the Tank is really, really staged, even though some of the problems might be real. We can talk a little bit about a few of them in the last couple episodes. But I mean, for example, this in the most recent episode that aired, Pipcorn, which was one of Barbara's Hall of Famers, you know, they come up with this problem where, you know, they don't have a manufacturing facility. So they meet with Barbara, and then right away, 2 seconds into the meeting, she's like, I know a guy, you're going to move to this facility. And then the next scene, they're walking around in this beautiful warehouse and problem solved. And it's like, yeah. You know, was that a problem they actually had? Was that a move that they were going to do anyways? But, you know, they decided to board this out and, you know, scene it out and pretend that they'd look really concerned about the fact that they're moving facilities. And it just didn't come across as believable to me. So that's my biggest issue with Beyond the Tank. It's just, I don't feel like these are real problems that need to be solved, but they kind of stretch them out to make it to up the drama, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I would say one thing the show does have going for it, though, is I do like seeing the sharks out of the tank here. And I'm sure that must have been the appeal as well. It's like, let's take Lori Grenier, let's take Kevin O'Leary out of this setting that you see them in every Friday night and see how they interact. I mean, if I would make a comparison to The Voice, one of the big criticisms of The Voice is that it essentially has been a show that is all about the coaches rather than the artists. And you don't see the coaches really mentoring the people that were on their team after the show. This feels very much like the opposite. And it's because I think the Sharks have their money invested here. Whereas, you know, we actually see in that Pipcorn segment that you were talking about, Barbara kind of outsources her Shark Tank business to a guy by the name of Michael Stevens, which is pretty, you know, front-facing to find out that it's not Barbara that's handling all that. But I do like the idea of, like, someone coming in and adamantly caring about this business and helping them along a little bit. It's not like, okay, we've inked the deal, you have my money, now I don't care about you anymore.
Right, no, I definitely like that. And it's nice to see the sharks out and about and not in understage lighting and can see kind of, like, what they look like in real life. But again, like, another thing I think that Beyond the Tank is missing is another thing that works really well with Shark Tank is the interaction between the sharks, see the sort of the back and forth little quibbling and, you know, making jokes with each other. Here, the sharks are kind of just out on their own with their products and we don't get to see that same interaction. So, I mean, that's kind of another reason why I haven't been drawn to Beyond the Tank previously, but I know a lot of people love it because they love digging into sort of these business obstacles and seeing how they get solved. And, you know, I have to admit, some of them are actual real obstacles. Like, well, you know, we saw in Purse Case, the most recent company that aired in the episode, she had a very real problem where she lost her co-founder. And that's not something that you can necessarily stage in terms of like getting rid of a co-founder. So that was a very compelling one to watch in terms of how I forgot what her name was able to deal with losing her friend and her co-founder and, you know, coming back with her business and getting that deal with Kitson.
I'd agree with that. So just speaking about the series in general, it started as kind of a thing that premiered. I mean, we're recording this a day before the show premiered last year on May 1st, 2015. It only went for like 3 episodes. I think it was just sort of a trial run. And I guess it was popular enough that they decided to bring it on for a second full-time season in 2016. So the second season aired in January, and it's going to be running its course until May. And yeah, but I've only seen a few episodes. I've only watched episodes 9, 10, and 11, which have aired since we started recording these Shark Tank podcasts. For the most part, I am assuming that they're all positive endings. As you talked about, it will flash to however much time later and everyone's doing better than they were initially. I know there was one case where I think one company had like gone bankrupt, but it seems like they were doing okay at the end. I can't really imagine that this type of show would end with a company saying like, well, we tried Kevin's advice and it didn't work and now we're out on the street.
Right. And you have to understand like Shark Tank's sort of meta narrative, which is inspirational, feel good, lighthearted, and very critically to make the show work. They need to show that the show does work. Like the investments can prop up businesses. The involvement of the sharks is a good thing. I know maybe we can talk about this on another podcast, but you know, there has been some criticism in different media outlets from people who've gone onto the show where it's like, you know, the involvement of a shark wasn't necessarily a helpful thing, or my appearance on the Shark Tank didn't necessarily help my company. And, you know, for the series to move past that and for the series to continue this narrative that, you know, we're such a good thing for the American dream, they need to have these stories end on a good tone.
So from the past few episodes, Jesmy, were there any particular companies or problems that stuck out to you? I know you talked a little bit about Pipcorn. You talked a little bit about Purse Case. Anything else?
Yeah, I mean, there was one from episode 10, the original runner company. Did you catch that one?
Yeah, so that was the case of one of these people who did not end up getting a deal initially. We flash back to her pitch, and she came off a little arrogant and blunt to people like Damon in particular. And essentially, we talked a little bit about this with Inchbug last week, about they had the same problem of how they had a very successful business they were essentially running on their own. They had a desire to go retail, and Are the Sharks were adamantly against that because they felt that, you know, why break what's, you know, hasn't been broken yet, essentially, and that she's made a lot of money just doing things on her own. When you go retail, you have to jump through a lot of hoops and satisfy a lot more people. So it's a much more of a headache.
Yeah, I mean, I thought this this segment was so fascinating for several reasons. One, she was someone who didn't originally get a pitch, but for some reason, she stuck out in Barbara's mind. So Barbara kind of goes out of her way to come back and discuss her business problems with her. Two, I think she brought up something, and I was actually impressed that the show brought this up, about the sort of underlying sexism in the Shark Tank, more so early on than lately. But, you know, again, this is something that we can talk about later. But I've noticed, as she commented on the pitch, like the way they sometimes talk to female entrepreneurs or female oriented products. I want to say it's outright sexist, but there are definitely sexist undertones that happen occasionally on the show, which is a great case study of like what happens with, you know, female entrepreneurs and how they're seen or more likely to be seen as aggressive, whereas like a man who might act the same way might just be seen as assertive, and that's more of a positive trait for them. So I was actually really happy to see them address this issue, and I think Barbara definitely felt that way, and that's what compelled her to come back to this company and try to help it out.
Yeah. Another one I really liked was the Bamboo-y from episode 9, which, again, was part of Lori's omnibus. It was sort of like the let's make paper towels out of bamboo instead of trees so that we can, you know, contribute to a greener planet. But the problem was that one of their founders, this guy named Noam, just was not a great presenter overall, especially when he was on QVC. And so Lori essentially had to step in and say, like, dude, scale it back a little bit. And I think it really speaks to just the wide variety of problems when it comes to running a business. And that's another thing that I enjoy about this show as well, is that it's not going to be every week, oh, we have too much product. Oh, we have too much demand.
Right.
Oh, we have too little space.
We are so successful. What do we do?
Exactly. There's a wide swath of problems that can exist when running a business. And even each episode, even though there are only three segments, each one definitely dedicates time to a different problem you would have when you're starting up your own business.
Yeah. And I mean, Beyond the Tank was not something that I was initially very much into. Like, I was very much into Shark Tank, and I just kind of started watching this once we started doing the podcast. And I can definitely see how it's just a nice companion show to just see like what happens with these products. And if you're more interested on the business end, like how do you encounter and solve these business problems? And can I just give a shout out? Do you remember a Handboard from episode 10? That sort of.
Yes. But then we also have a Ham Board.
Yes. did you catch what he named his grandchild at the end of that segment?
Stone Rider.
I mean, no comment.
Definitely not. But you know what? That's the perfect. I think it's unfortunately it's the thing of like there was a Freakonomics thing about like depending on how you name your child, it might determine their economic status. I feel like sometimes when you name a kid like Stone Rider, you're basically determining what future they're going to dive into. There will not be a president of our country named Stone Rider anytime soon.
What potentially their recreational activities might be. I won't expand there much, but I think you know what I'm getting at.
Yeah, what activities that might be considered illegal in some states, but legal in others might be taken upon. I'm lighting what you're offering here in a way.
Awesome. So is there anything else you want to talk about in terms of Beyond the Tank?
No, I mean, what I'll offer to our listeners here is, again, another form of shark accountability in that we talked a little bit about the more general broad strokes of the show. If you feel like this is something that you want us to talk about weekly, I mean, I think both of us would be up for maybe tacking on a Beyond the Tank portion at the end of each podcast for the corresponding episode. But let us know. You know, I know, as we said, a good amount of you were interested in Beyond the Tank when we first talked about it. So definitely let us know if you think it's definitely worth having a discussion along with the show proper.
Yeah, I think if enough people are interested in, we can definitely talk about the episode at the end of our regular Shark Tank podcast. When did this TV show air? It airs on Tuesdays or Wednesdays?
Tuesday nights.
Tuesday nights. Yeah. So it's like we could definitely talk about the Tuesday before episode on our regular Shark Tank podcast if that's something you're into.
Yeah, really speaking to the wrap up aspect. There'll be a wrap up of the Shark Tank empire. But that being said, whether it's Beyond the Tank centric or not, we do want to hear from you guys, especially, you know, in the hopes if we do more bonus podcasts down the line, we want to hear from you about other pitches you want us to talk about or just thoughts about the show in general. So you have a bunch of ways to reach out to us. As always, you can leave a comment here on robhasawebsite.com. While you're here, also please make sure you're subscribed to the Reality TV Wrap Ups feed, where you get not only this but great coverage of the challenge, which just started, as well as Jordan Parhar's Reality TV Happy Hour. So lots of great stuff to fill your earbuds all week long. And as always, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I am at a Mike Bloom type. Jasmeet is Jasmeet Sidhu. So next week we are back with Shark Tank proper, with, well, I forget his name again, Steve Sachs,
Chris Sacca.
Yeah. Wow. I was thinking about a baseball player. That just shows how much I know about this guy. Chris Sacca will be guesting next week, and we'll be back next week talking about the original show itself or flashing forward to 2016 again. Maybe we'll talk about some Beyond the Tank. Who knows? We'd love to hear from you guys. As always, let's close out with the hashtag. Jasmeet, maybe in honor of Scrub Daddy being called the Kelly Clarkson of Shark Tank, do we want to, how about like a scrubber like this or Spongy Clarkson?
I like a scrubber like this. That's a good one.
A scrubber like this. Yeah, American Idol just ended, so I feel like it's very poignant.
Yes, we got to give our ode to American Idol, so let's do it.
Exactly. The only way we can give an ode to American Idol on a Shark Tank podcast. Right. This is really the only middle of that Venn diagram. All right, so that's going to do it for this week of the Shark Tank Wrap Up. We'll be back to recap a brand new episode of Shark Tank and possibly Beyond the Tank. But for now, the tank is closed.